What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Bring in show music, please.
Hi, I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. Today on Squawk Pod. A direct military confrontation, Israel weighing its response to a first-ever attack by Iran on Saturday. The New York Times' David Sanger on the shifting geopolitics and the threat of a wider war.
You'll remember those 2015 negotiations to stop Iran's nuclear program. Russia and China were part of the negotiations. They were sitting on the American side of the table.
The tables have indeed turned.
This time, they are part of what the Iranians call the axis of resistance to the West.
Plus, what is in store for the markets if things escalate?
Typically, an expected potential escalation of geopolitical conflict is not the thing to really drive the next, you know, weeks and months in markets.
And it's tax day. The tax man, a.k.a. the IRS commissioner, Daniel Werfel, cometh.
It's in your interest to get your taxes done because two out of three of you, we're going to pay you.
Even if you're filing for 2020.
Go file your taxes, folks. There may be money in it.
It's Monday, April 15th, 2024. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Stand Andrew by in 3, 2, 1. Cue Andrew.
Good morning and welcome to Squawk Box right here on CNBC. We're live at the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. I'm Andrew Ross Sorkin, and I'm hanging out with Leslie Picker and Mike Santoli. Becky and Joe are off today. Good morning, guys.
Morning.
Good morning.
What a morning, because we have a lot to do. So much going on.
First up today on the podcast, Iran's 300 drones and missiles launched at military targets inside Israel. It is the first time Iran has ever attacked Israel directly from Iranian soil. And the country says that its attack is a response to an Israeli attack on an Iranian embassy in Syria earlier this month. Now, Israel weighs its own response. The drones and missiles were not a complete surprise. In fact, on Friday, markets here in the U.S. sold off. The S&P 500 had its worst day since January in anticipation of this possible attack. Plus, the hot inflation data we saw last week, it was a bad mix for the markets. The Dow closed down 1.25%. Let's start the new week on Wall Street and get back to Mike Santoli.
Let's get to the reaction in Washington to Iran's attack on Israel over the weekend. Ayman Javers joins us now with the latest details.
Yeah, good morning, Mike. The White House said this weekend's unprecedented Iranian attack in Israel was largely rebuffed by Israeli and U.S. defenses. Now, most of the defensive work was handled by the Israeli Arrow system, but American destroyers and a U.S. Patriot missile battery also participated in the defense of Israel over the weekend. Because they were able to destroy most of the drones, cruise missiles, and ballistic missiles that were fired by the Iranians, Israeli officials said casualties were limited to just one, a 10-year-old girl who was severely injured by shrapnel. Now, White House officials said there was virtually no infrastructure damage in Israel at all. Still, the fact that Iran and Israel are now in direct military conflict raises the prospect of a wider Middle East war at a time when the United States has been urging a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. President Biden returned to the White House from Delaware Saturday, monitored events from the Situation Room at the White House in real time, and in a call with congressional leaders on Sunday afternoon, President Biden urged House Speaker Mike Johnson to pass a military aid bill this week to support Israel and Ukraine. But the speaker was publicly noncommittal in a media appearance yesterday. Seems like there might be a possibility he'll strip out the Ukrainian piece of that. We'll see how that goes this week. Now, the Iranian attack, a response to an Israeli strike in Syria, which killed a number of Iranian military officials, appears to be over for now. But the situation is tense, and it's not clear whether Israeli forces will retaliate in turn or whether the Iranians will mount any further direct strikes. Back over to you guys.
Ayman, thanks very much. We'll see as things develop.
Check out crypto, because for those who are watching or trying to watch what the markets might or might not do over the weekend, a lot of folks were focused on Bitcoin since it was trading literally as some of these strikes were taking place. Right now, it's at $66,609. That is a rebound. It had gone down. What was the low, Mike, did you see over the weekend?
Over the weekend, low 60s.
Low 60s, I think. And, you know, I was actually on Twitter trying to understand some of the maneuverings because, of course, of the various theses, if you will, around what Bitcoin should or should not be in this kind of moment.
Yeah, and it doesn't really conform to anything you think linearly. I think more generally speaking, what we're seeing is the fact that the markets in general were clenched up on Friday ahead of this. This is pretty well telegraphed. You also have the broader context, which is typically an expected potential escalation of geopolitical conflict is not the thing to really drive the next weeks and months in markets. And I do think that markets are already dealing with other stuff. So right now, a little bit of the pressure taken off because it doesn't seem like it's going to spiral at the moment. Oil is going to always be the lead. If it's not coming through the oil markets, stock market and bond market can kind of deal. And the other part of it is, we're only getting back at the open, if this is the way it stands, a third of Friday's loss in the S&P.
But can I ask this question? And Leslie Picker spent a lot of time with Jamie Dimon recently doing various interviews. One of the things that he just said in that annual report, literally about a week ago now, 2 weeks ago, was just how much he felt like we were potentially on the precipice in a way that we hadn't been. And you're right.
Yeah.
It is at the beginning of wars and things, at least historically, bizarrely, there have been some sellers, but increasingly, more recently, people don't focus on it. I still go back and think about what happened in the market on October 7th.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Went up.
Yeah.
It did. People, now, you still had 3 weeks where it was weak after that, but it wasn't sort of driven mostly by that.
And oil seemed to react this way as well, which begs the question, you know, to your point about Jamie, how the markets price in changing world order, and can they, are they equipped to do so, despite the fact that so many of these shops that are driving the market are algorithmically based and... looking at various headlines.
I go back to when it comes to these things, tell me specifically today what the market is supposed to be repricing. That the Middle East is perpetually volatile and it's a hazardous place and there's awful things going on. You know what I mean? Like, what today should the markets be taking from the events over the weekend that is incremental to what we knew on Friday? And so if you think about it that way, and of course, all the other factors involved, we're still dealing with maybe a repriced Fed and inflation, all the rest of it. If it's not coming through the oil markets and it's going to create this, you know, supply jolt in potentially, oil going up.
Well, and then there's the flip side, just how much spending. If you believe that this actually was going to spiral into a war, the amount of spending that would take place as a result.
Sure. Well, that's true. I mean, that's always a little bit of on the back end. Yeah, there's another consequence.
Meantime, a very cool event happening over the weekend, the annual Breakthrough Prize ceremony taking place in Los Angeles this weekend. Hollywood stars and leaders in business and technology hitting the red carpet. They do this on behalf of science. It's a very fascinating dinner. I've been to it before. Kim Kardashian, Margot Robbie, Bradley Cooper, Bill Gates, Eric Schmidt, and Elon Musk all at that event to celebrate science and scientists. And Musk had this to say about his predictions for the presidential election.
He's going to win the White House in 2024.
Who do you think will win the White House in 2032? Which type of AI? Transformers or diffusion?
The honorees include scientists who work advances for treatments in cystic fibrosis, Parkinson's disease, and cancer. And it is, it's become the Oscars of science. And, you know, but you laugh in some ways, but we don't put enough attention on scientists, and to go out and celebrate them this way and to try to put attention on them, I think, is a really great thing.
I'm waiting for the scientists to show up on the Oscars red carpet. We'll show them, you know, when they
reciprocate. That's what we got to hope for.
With the goodie bags and all.
That's
Hopefully they're very just as good for the scientists as they are.
All right,
for the
so Elon says we have, two more terms of human presidents. And then we're,
Right, and then which would you prefer? which type of AI would you prefer?
Take the full 8 years to figure that out.
Cheese will be next.
Coming up on Squawk Pod, the risky landscape in the Middle East. The New York Times national security correspondent, David Sanger, joins us.
I suspect that at least for a while we're going to see a calm. But there is a Rubicon that's been crossed here. In the 45 years since the Iranian Revolution, Iran has never attacked Israel directly from its soil. And I think the taboo on the Israelis attacking back is now lifted.
people today can spend half their lives over 50. So it's good to be financially ready for what's important to you as you get older, like a family vacation. Or starting your dream business.
Welcome to Connie's Coffee. How may I help you?
AARP's trusted financial tools can help you plan for whatever your future holds. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Start planning today at aarp.org/moneytools.
Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones, from powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY, a big idea that inspired the world to invest differently, and still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
This is Squawk Pod, today with Andrew Ross Sorkin, Leslie Picker, and Michael Santoli. Here's Andrew.
Tensions in the Middle East have hit a new high as Israel considers retaliation against Iran after that missile and drone attack over the weekend. For a closer look at all of this, I want to welcome my friend David Sanger, New York Times White House and national security correspondent, one of the great veteran experts of this space. His new book is out. It is called New Cold Wars, China's Rise, Russia's Invasion, and America's struggle to defend the West. And in truth, I want to get into the China and Russia of it all because it relates to this entire story. But I want to get just right at this weekend and where we are in this particular moment. I know it's impossible to handicap, but we were talking about, do we think this escalates? Do we think it doesn't? Where do we go from here? What is your expectation?
So it's a really fraught moment, a really hard one. It was really interesting to see President Biden on the phone to Bibi Netanyahu hours after this was over saying, take the win. You know, you shot down all this stuff. You started this in some ways by doing the strike in Damascus, which the Americans were very upset about and didn't think the Israelis should go do for fear of exactly this. The whole effort by Biden so far has been avoid escalation here. And I suspect that at least for a while, we're going to see a calm. But there is a Rubicon that's been crossed here. In the 45 years since the Iranian Revolution, Iran has never attacked Israel directly from its soil. And I think the taboo on the Israelis attacking back is now lifted.
Okay, but let me ask you, Biden may be trying to put pressure on Netanyahu, but that hasn't, especially in recent weeks.
He doesn't have a great track record.
Yet. So that's the question. To the extent that you've been doing reporting over the weekend on this, what is your sense of where Netanyahu is, where the Israeli people are, what this government around Netanyahu is telling him?
So he is obviously desperate to stay in power. And I think the longer that the crisis goes on generally helps him. But I think he also recognizes that if he goes back too hard on Iran right now and this turns into a general conflagration, he's going to lose his objectives in Gaza and he's going to lose the other. So, you know, he's probably going to stay focused on Gaza. He's got to do something in response to this.
Right.
The question is, can they calibrate it? And do the Iranians catch the calibration? Because the biggest mistake that happens out here is someone reads wrong how the other guy is going to react.
Okay, let me ask you about a different read, if you will, which is, and it goes to this book, New Cold Wars, which is the Russia and China of it all, and their relationship both together and, frankly, potentially as a supporter of Iran.
Yep.
And how that relates to whatever pressure points we have or leverage we have or, frankly, don't have with either of those countries.
So, Andrew, this is the big change from even 9 or 10 years ago. You'll remember those 2015 negotiations to stop Iran's nuclear program.
Right.
Russia and China were part of the negotiations. They were sitting on the American side of the table, right? This time, they are part of what the Iranians call the axis of resistance to the West. Obviously, Iran is providing drones to Russia. They may be on their way to providing missiles to them. The Russians are not going to be part of the effort here to bring this down. Also, China and Russia are perfectly happy to see the U.S. wrapped into the Middle East again, as you were saying before I came on.
But what about our relationship with China? Janet Yellen just got back from China.
Yep.
I mean, we talk about this sort of frenemy-ish, I don't know how you want to describe it, relationship at the moment. But is there no leverage to be had in that regard?
There is leverage, and the leverage comes from the fact that the Chinese economy has finally slowed down. How many times did you and I sit around saying these guys are going to hit the rocks at some moment?
Yep.
They finally hit them. I think it's the sense of the Americans who deal with China the most, particularly the government officials, that this warming that we've seen, including in the Yellen visit, is a temporary thing. And if you look, the book tries to trace where we have been with China and Russia. And the main theme of this book is while we were busy doing the wars on terrorism, while we were focused on the Middle East, we basically ignored the revival of superpower conflict. And that is going to be the dominant theme of the next 20 or 30 or 40 years. And we did it by deluding ourselves into believing that Russia and China, each for different reasons, would sign up to the norms of the Western economy.
Is there an answer to that, though, which is to say we missed it? We're now behind. We're on the back foot.
Yep.
If you wanted to get on the front foot,
What do you do? Okay, three things. Okay, the first is you recognize that this is the primary thing you've got to go focus on. Biden tried to go back and do his pivot to the Pacific. Once again, he's being caught up in the Middle East like everyone else. You can't lose your focus because the Chinese don't lose their focus. The second is you've got to sustain the pressure on Putin. All of the record of our dealing with Putin is whenever he detects that there is significant weakness and we're going to back away, he will go on the next step. So the idea that the United States would say, okay, we were all in on Ukraine, but no, this is too hard, that's exactly what Putin was sort of betting on us doing. And the third thing you need to do is if you're going to really focus on the investments, including in bringing back the semiconductor industry and all that, if you decide you're going to do industrial policy, then you have to be all in and do it in a big, sustained way.
Okay, here's a hypothetical counterfactual. If former President Trump were our president either today or becomes the president again in November, this dynamic changes how?
So two different ways. On Russia, he has said he will solve this problem in 24 hours. There's only one way to solve the problem in 24 hours is to go to the Russians and say, okay, you take this, this, and this, and basically hand that to the Ukrainians as a fait accompli. I think if we did that, that probably would begin to shatter the alliances. And I've just been living in Europe for 3 months, and they're clearly concerned about that. On China, it's a slightly different thing. He was very eager to go strike deals with the Chinese until COVID happened. That's when he turned around. I actually think he would probably try to reengage with Xi Jinping. Now, maybe would he reengage on the right issues? Hard to know.
And by doing that, how would that ultimately either solve or deal with the Israel-Iran issue?
You know, I don't think it would. I think it's the Russians who have more influence on Iran. The Chinese have some. The reason I think that the Chinese would be perfectly happy to see Trump come back is that a Trump era is a chaos era. And in a chaos era, they get to go move around the world as they want without his straight-on focus.
Okay. David Sanger, one of the smartest people I know on national security issues, the book couldn't be timed better. New Cold Wars. Thank you for coming in this morning.
Thank you. Great to be with you guys.
Investors, as ever, are closely watching the Fed. Steve Liesman joins us now with how this weekend's geopolitical developments might impact decisions by central bank officials. Steve.
Yeah, Mike, I think what happened, you look at the trade Sunday night through the futures markets and then this morning, I think it was revealed that what happened Friday was essentially a flight to safety, right? And you take a look at the 10-year, and it looks sort of like a V. We've kind of basically put it back, right? And it's you had a surge above 450, and it was like, okay, time to take notice of that.
Yep.
And then coming back the other way now this morning, it went all the way down to below 450.
Yeah, the 10-year,
And what that does is it locks in the feeling of the market, or brings back the feeling of the market. If you go back and look at the January 2025 Fed funds contract, what happened on Wednesday last week? It just shot straight up. And you take a look at that, it looks like, I don't know, one of those cliffs at Yosemite, right? And what that did is it added a quarter point to the outlook for the Fed. I think that probably is right, which means that there are still cuts to be had there. There's that cliff right there, you can see. What time is that, Leslie? That's Wednesday morning at 8:30 when we had the CPI number coming in. So the question became, you can see they flirted with maybe taking some of that off. Look, when you listen to Fed officials these days, geopolitical risks were already on their radar. But which way were they on their radar? On their radar for potential inflation upside from shipping disruptions, just a pure surge in the cost of oil. So that looks to me today to be kind of flat, and there's no additional risk there. And it's just one of the things the market was dealing with. You have earnings this week. We've got retail sales coming up at 8:30 this morning. And there were a whole slew of things out there. So I think the Fed is mindful of this. If there's a surge in oil, it'll ask the question, how long is the surge in oil going to be?
Yeah, and I guess also it would seem to matter why the surge in oil is happening. And if you think it's going to be more of a restraint on consumption than it's going to be inflationary. It is worth remembering, I mean, when Russia did invade Ukraine, it was like weeks before the Fed initiated its tightening campaign, right, in February of 2022. So, you know, that was an exacerbating factor on an inflationary story they already were consumed with.
They didn't see it really as something that was, they were still in that sort of, is it transitory?
Yeah.
Mike, you've been here, you know, almost as long as I have, maybe, and doing this. There's this sort of pattern the market goes through when something like this happens. There's a sell-off. And sometimes within days, it kind of gets back to where it was. So this did not rise to that. I think there is still headline risk. And some people may come in this morning and say, you're doing what? You're long. But the extent to which David Sanger sat here, you can't do this without listening to somebody like that, right? Because this is now the focus you have to have, which is, okay, what is the risk of an Israeli retaliation? What is the risk of something? Which is all, for me at least, out of our pay grade, right?
Can I ask you a different question?
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about it, I think, later in the broadcast. Bitcoin.
Yeah, I saw your, I don't know.
Well, I was going to say, Saturday night.
Don't ask me about Bitcoin. I am the worst
Saturday
possible
night,
person.
It tanks on the back of this news. And I was just, I honestly, genuinely trying to figure out what it means to the extent that it was supposed to be a safe haven. You think to yourself, okay, then maybe it would actually go up, not down. If you thought that it was supposed to be a hedge against inflation, you'd think it would go up, not down, or at least hold.
It hasn't worked on inflation. It trades with the NASDAQ.
Well, if it trades with the NASDAQ, then it's just a speculative asset, and that's what it is.
Right. And
that's all it is.
I think it's eye of the beholder in terms of what it is.
But a speculative asset that's made a lot of people rich. I mean, that's the other problem. And I have completely thought that people who trade in cryptocurrency mostly don't know what a currency is, because it's not a currency.
No, I think that's almost gone away.
But even if you just said it was supposed to be a digital gold, over a weekend at that particular
gold
moment.
Peaked. What was really interesting is gold's been on a huge tear, and it peaked middle of the day on Friday, and then it was almost like crescendo.
Right.
That was why, Mike, we were having a debate as to whether or not this really was a true flight to safety because of gold's behavior. It didn't make any sense. If in the classic flight to safety, you buy bonds, you sell stocks, you buy gold, you buy the dollar.
$300 in no time before that, right? So you have to kind of use what the price has been doing already for a little while.
Well, I think maybe what we're learning, Andrew, if we put this is an interesting idea. You put gold and Bitcoin together and you say, once something becomes, you know, either highly or speculatively valued, it loses its value as a safety instrument.
That's interesting.
Right? If it gets to be too, then all of a sudden, you know. Now look at the dollar, which is really interesting to me. It's up near 106. It was stronger this morning. It's been stronger throughout this. And what do you have going on there? You have the idea that the ECB is probably on track to cut in June. By the way, what I was going to talk about today before this concern about Iran, we talked about this on Friday.
Yep.
I don't think cuts are off the table.
No.
There. I think the market has kind of said, oh, no, and I don't.
You're saying you don't think all cuts are off the table?
I don't think all cuts are off
but
the table.
But if we had this conversation in June, when the first cut was supposed to happen as of 2 weeks ago, that's now maybe not in the cards, if you believe the market.
Right.
You're saying you think it could be in the cards?
Not June, but July is possible. I think Larry Summers has once again dominated the conversation, and his pessimism over inflation and his pessimism over what the Fed will do here. I think that you could have a couple good months. I wish I had I had these great pull quotes from Ian Shepherdson, whose piece you should read. He goes, look, I have a medium-term forecast for inflation to come down, and I have no reason to change that. All of the things that were out there, nothing has changed. You have these, he calls these blips at the beginning of the year.
But what's the key driver for those cuts sooner rather than later? When we hear Fed officials speak, it's all about patience, and, you know, we want to see what happens. And now patience potentially as it pertains to, you know, potential flare-ups with geopolitics. So what would be the motivation to cut sooner?
A, I think the Fed wants to cut. B, I think that
You think the Fed wants to cut even with what's going on?
Yes.
Listen to the rhetoric, Andrew, right? Yep. The statement says, we do not believe it is good to cut until we have confidence. I just did a terrible paraphrase of that. But what does that tell you? What's policy? To cut.
Yeah, but I will say,
Mike agrees with me.
Now, I know Mike agrees with
you. I'll tell you, and Mike on
I'll tell you who may not agree with you, though, who's been right about this as well, which is, you know, Roger Ferguson, who I think has been
But he's still
on.
Saying patience. He's not saying, like,
no cut. He's not saying no cuts.
We got Roger coming up at 7:30, so we can ask him that, and that is a tease to people to tune in then, because whenever Roger comes, I'm always turning up the volume to make sure. And I'm kind of sorry Joe's not here. We're not talking about the Masters this morning. We could be talking about it at length. But listen, I want to finish answering Leslie's question. The Fed, I believe it thinks that it is in a restrictive territory. And I also think it believes it is higher than it needs to be.
Yes.
Okay? And maybe we can ask Roger this question too, right? And therefore, I believe it can cut, or it thinks it can cut, and still remain restrictive. All it's looking for right now is the ability to do so. And it can't do so with inflation either stuck where it's at now. What's going to happen on April 26th? Go ahead, ask me.
What's going to happen
PCE
on April 26th?
Inflation.
Thank you for asking.
PCE. The,
thank you, Mike.
It's going to be under 3. It's going to be 2.7.
No, no, no. What's that? 2.8 to 2.7.
Yeah.
So it's going to get a little bit of that progress. And if some of these other things.
And the dot setter at the end of the year, it would be 2.6 and they would have 3 cuts. The dots last month.
Does the man do my job for me or what? I mean,
I'm just saying that the framework is funneling you in that direction.
And the framework is to cut, the framework is for lower inflation. I think we've been through a bout here. I think people want to, you know, and look, Leslie, to the first part of your question, if you have higher oil prices, if those higher oil prices start to bleed in from the headline to the core, then all bets are off. I'm just saying, don't forget the direction the Fed was leaning in. Don't forget what its policy is. I actually did both stories. I did the geopolitical story and I did the story I was going to do, which is the story about the idea that I still think there's a framework out there and there's the possibility. What do you have to get? You've got to get the April data and the May data to cooperate.
All right. We'll see what we get. See you later, Steve. Thanks.
Next on Squawk Pod.
Can I ask a terrible question?
Please.
It is tax day in America, and Andrew, like many Americans, waits or has waited until the last minute to file. But we have the guy in charge of the IRS, Commissioner Danny Werfel, has a message for those of us who cut it a little close.
Don't walk down to the post office. File electronically, select direct deposit, and we will get your refund in under 21 days.
From pit lane to podium, the Las Vegas Grand Prix is providing fans a race day experience at the speed they deserve. With the help of T-Mobile for Business, our 5G advanced network solutions are powering race day operations with event-wide connectivity. From streamlined gate entry to an immersive app, giving fans blazing fast access to the sport they love. This is accelerating innovation. This is the Las Vegas Grand Prix with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
You're listening to Squawk Pod. And yes, procrastinators, it is April 15th. Here's Andrew.
Despite everything that's going on in the world, today also happens to be tax day. And a new IRS report out this morning highlighting a variety of improvements the agency believes that it's made this tax season to try to make it easier for Americans due to the Inflation Reduction Act. I want to bring in IRS Commissioner Danny Werfel. Good morning to you.
Morning.
I was asking if you were watching the Masters over the weekend. You said it's a busy weekend for the IRS.
It is.
Because, you know, it's a busy weekend for everybody else who's trying to get their tax materials completed. It's a busy weekend for you because
Well, because a lot of the returns come in
over the weekend.
Over the weekend and today. On a day like today, April 15th, we might see a million returns come in every hour. And at this point, it's really making sure that our technology can handle the load, and so far, so good.
And you were saying how many filings an hour?
A million.
A million an hour?
Yeah, on April 15th, yep.
Okay, can I ask a terrible question?
Please.
And I've been that guy. I've gone down to the post office down here on 34th Street because it's still open to like midnight, you know, on the 15th.
Yes.
Just so I can get the postmark.
Yes.
If I got the postmark tomorrow, what would happen?
You potentially would get a late filing penalty or fee. Yes. But here's what I'm going to tell you to do.
Is there a grace period or not?
Here's what I'm going to tell you to do.
Yeah.
Don't walk down to the post office. File electronically.
Right.
Select direct deposit, and we will get your refund in under 21 days. And here's something that a lot of taxpayers don't realize. Two out of every three taxpayers that are going to file by tonight's deadline are actually owed a refund. And so it's in your interest to get your taxes done.
Right.
Because two out of three of you, we're going to pay you.
Okay. One of the things that you are doing this year, and you're running a pilot program, which is fascinating.
Yeah.
To effectively create a portal where people, some people, not a lot of people, but some people can actually file online. They don't have to use TurboTax. They don't have to do something else. They go straight to the website.
Yes. It's a new way of filing your taxes. First time we've done it. Online, direct with the IRS, for free. It's called Direct File, and we ran a pilot this year.
Right.
We were in 12 states. We had 19 million people in 12 states eligible.
And how many people, can you tell us how many people have tried to use it?
We know for a fact that it's in the tens of thousands, and I also know that in the last 24 to 48 hours, it's really ramped up in terms of the number of people who have filed using Direct File. The feedback on it has been great. We've heard from taxpayers that it is easy to use. It was quick. Of course, everyone loves the price tag. It's free.
It's free. You don't have to use TurboTax. You don't have to use an account. I mean, do you need an accountant? Or these are for relatively uncomplicated taxes.
Yeah, this year, the eligible taxpayer typically had a standard deduction, no separate business income. And you don't need an accountant. The reason why this is important is because we want taxpayers to have options for how they file. We're not saying use Direct File, it's the only way to go. We're saying when you come to irs.gov,
right,
or you're searching what's the best way for me to file my taxes, it's better for you to have options.
Right.
So if you want to work with a software provider, you should.
But the folks at Intuit have been lobbying like crazy people to avoid this from ever happening. So is your expectation, I know you don't talk politics, but is your expectation that this is going to roll out in a major way come next year after this pilot program?
We are going to make an announcement later this spring on the future of the program, but I will say that the results so far have been encouraging. I'd also say that, you know, the IRS doesn't run the tax system alone. These companies are our partners, and they play a critical role in making the whole thing work. Here's what's interesting about this filing season. We had a significant increase in the number of people filing for free, not electronically, not just with Direct File, but with the software providers as well.
What about tax cheating? Can we talk about tax cheating? Not the folks who are not filing at all. That's a whole separate issue. But what is the stuff that you're looking for this year that you think you guys had not looked for in the past?
It's all about complexity. It's the complex returns, because what happened was the IRS was underfunded for many years before the Inflation Reduction Act. And what happens when you're underfunded, you lose pace with what's going on in the world and what's going on with the economy. And for simple filers, middle, low income and mom and pops, we didn't lose pace. There's no new wave of audits coming for those individuals,
and
those small businesses. Where we are really working to increase scrutiny is on the complex filers, where we believe there's a risk of tax evasion. So I'm talking about, for example, multinational corporations who may be inappropriately moving money to other international tax jurisdictions with a beneficial tax rate.
So you're not talking about, now we're into businesses, you're not even talking about individuals.
We are looking at millionaires and billionaires.
There's always the focus on millionaires and billionaires, but you think the real money is in corporations. By the way, you brought a lawsuit, I believe, against Microsoft recently. As it relates to taxes.
Well, I'm not going to comment on any specific taxpayer, but our focus broadly is in these three buckets: large multinational corporations or large corporations in general, complex partnerships, some of the largest in the world, and then the wealthiest individuals in the United States. These are millionaires and billionaires. And where we started was at the most simple issue, which is millionaires and billionaires who owed back taxes, who are delinquent, or who haven't filed. And we've already, in just a couple of months, collected $500 million in tax delinquencies from millionaires and billionaires.
Okay, last question. For those, just, it's like news you can use. How long do you need to save all your stuff? And what is, dare I ask, because I think there are people who have said to themselves, you know what, nobody's auditing me. I'm going to take a risk here and there because no one's ever going to find me. What is the true statute of limitations for this stuff?
Well, first of all, let me start by saying you play by the rules.
I'm suggesting right? They do. I'm just asking for those who are trying to understand, because I look, we've had people on this broadcast forever say, well, you're never going to be audited. The chance of you getting audited is like infinitesimal. And our audience, by the way, is in the millionaire and billionaire class oftentimes.
Yeah. So here's what I would say. I actually like to look at it from the positive standpoint. Let me give you an example. In 2020, if you didn't file your taxes and we owe you a refund, today's the day. File your 2020 taxes, and we can pay that refund.
Hold on. You did not even file a return in 2020, and you're offering refunds for people who haven't?
I am, because we want people. Look, here's the mission of the IRS.
I don't even understand this. You just told me that if I file tomorrow, I could get fined.
Right.
These people are going to file 4 years later, and they're going to get a refund?
The only reason why you would get a late penalty is if you owed money.
Okay.
So if you do not owe money and you file late, we owe you money, there's no penalty. Okay? So here's the deal.
Uh-huh.
If we owed you a refund all the way back in 2020, you mentioned statute of limitations. That is running out.
Okay. And here's why I'm to get the refund.
Here's why I'm in your studio emphasizing
okay.
this. Is because the IRS's mission, our goal, is to make sure people pay what they owe and not a penny more, but also that we're getting people the refunds and the credits that they're entitled to. That is just as important to us. And so when we sit here and we know that there are thousands and even millions of people out there from 2020 who we owe a refund who haven't filed yet, I'm urging them, file by today so we can get you your refund.
Okay. Commissioner, thank you. Go file your taxes, folks. There may be money in it.
Absolutely.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's Squawk Pod for today. Thanks for starting your week with us. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Thanks to Leslie Picker and Mike Santoli for sitting in today. You can tune into our show weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 Eastern and stream live on Peacock. Or get the best of Squawk right in your ears. Follow Squawk Pod wherever you listen to podcasts. And before you go, we are in the last few days of voting for the Webby Awards People's Voice winners. Squawk Pod is a nominee, and you can support us. There's a link to take you right there in today's show notes. Thanks for your vote. We'll meet you right back here tomorrow.
We are clear. Thanks, guys.
From their innovative practice facility to unmatched views from the fairway, the PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with 5G solutions from T-Mobile for Business. Together, we're using AI-powered analytics to expand coaching tools and bringing fans closer to the pros with 5G-connected cameras. This is game-changing innovation. This is the PGA of America with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.